This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show. You're listening to the Zoomer Week in Review, brought to you by Carp, helping you unlock money you didn't know you had. Members-only discounts that can save you tons. Find out more at carp.ca.
Good afternoon. Welcome to the Zoomer Week in Review, all things Zoomer worldwide. I'm Christine Ross for Libby Znaimer. In a week when the government bailed out Air Canada with customer refunds as part of the deal, there's renewed talk of travel post-pandemic. But how will your travel plans be different? For one, expect to pay more. And what have we learned about living sustainably during this health crisis as we celebrate the second Earth Day of the pandemic on Thursday? But first, here are your Zoomer headlines from around the world. Tel Aviv University researchers have made a groundbreaking discovery in the fight against brain cancer by preventing it from spreading. Glioblastoma is an aggressive type of cancer that can occur in the brain or spinal cord. The team detected a failure in the brain's immune system and isolated the protein responsible for allowing the deadly cancer to spread. The lead researcher says the findings could also be used to treat pain of patients with sickle cell anemia. Spain is about to launch a nationwide trial of a four-day work week, and some say the pandemic could force the idea to become mainstream. The concept isn't new, but Spain's pilot is on track to be the first national test. Even before the pandemic, concerns about work-life balance had pushed some companies to experiment with a shorter work week, some reporting benefits almost immediately. Absenteeism fell 30%, and satisfaction levels were up among staff and customers. In Canada, Shopify launched shorter work week trials of their own. For the first time, Canada takes the top spot in this year's Best Countries report, a ranking by a group of international organizations. Of the 78 countries ranked, Canada is number one based on the following criteria: cultural, political and technological influences, and social purpose. Japan and Germany are number two and three, respectively. Switzerland, the previous number one, fell to number four. The U.S. ranks sixth.
Because we, the people, have the power to build a better future.
The Montreal High School, where Vice President Kamala Harris attended in her teen years, says it would love to host her. The chair of the English Montreal School Board has written to Foreign Affairs Minister Marc Garneau to formally request that Harris stop over in Montreal during a future official visit to Canada. The chair writes the board was proud to see the graduate of Westmount High School ascend to the vice presidency last November.
I can't even describe how much I'm looking forward to this meal.
A posthumous collection of Anthony Bourdain's best travelogues offer up a guide to the world. The new book includes essays from friends and family about the late TV chef. Bourdain's brother Chris reminisces about exploring their native New Jersey and discovering unexpected ancestors in Uruguay. Also in the book, go behind the scenes at a Hanoi restaurant where Bourdain had a casual meal with Barack Obama. Bourdain died in 2018, and his longtime assistant finished the book as a way to serve his legacy. World Travel comes out this week.
Darius is Jeffrey's dad, and he's over 4 foot, and he's now 5 years old. He's getting an old man now.
How's this for a hair-raising crime? Police say one of the world's biggest rabbits was stolen this week from its backyard enclosure at a home in England. Police won't say why they think the disappearance of Darius, a continental giant rabbit, is a theft and not an escape. The gray-brown bunny is over 4 feet and holds the Guinness World Record as the longest. He weighs about 20 pounds. The rabbit's owner is now offering more than a $1,000 reward for his safe return. Despite a turbulent year of grounded air travel around the world, experts predict travel will be cleared for takeoff post-pandemic, but with some noticeable changes. Air travel will be more complex and carry a few unavoidable features: higher travel and insurance costs, and a possible vaccine passport. I spoke with Richard Smart, CEO of the Travel Industry Council of Ontario. So I guess I have to start and ask you about this week's big air travel news and Ottawa's financial deal with Air Canada, which does carry the stipulation for customer refunds, not the vouchers. How is this decision going to impact travel?
Well, this was a significant announcement that the Canadian government made. And you have to recall, TECO, first of all, is all about consumer protection. We're Consumer Protection Regulatory Authority for Ontario. And anything that benefits consumers, you know, related to travel is a good thing. So with the Air Canada announcement, we know that so many consumers have been upset, rightfully so, with having their business trips or leisure trips canceled due to COVID over the last year. And in many cases, had those trip cancellations replaced with these future travel credits or travel vouchers. So the fact that Air Canada is coming out now with a refund policy for those past cancellations, but also with a policy around how they're going to handle refunds in the future, I think is a positive step forward for the travel industry as a whole.
So people have been isolated now for more than a year, dreaming of that first big trip post-pandemic. What is the number one thing that travelers are going to notice that's different?
Well, travel has changed. You hear the words new normal going forward, and that's still fluid and still evolving. But clearly, I'd say travel for at least the next little while is going to be more complex. We have to assess the destinations that Canadian travelers are going to, and there's been lots of news out there that a lot of destinations, some are ahead of Canada in the vaccination programs, but according to the World Health Organization, there's still a large number of countries that'll take well into 2023 before they're fully vaccinated. So from a consumer protection standpoint, the whole travel supply chain is evolving into this new normal. And that's why we're working with our travel agencies and tour operators to make sure that the sort of disclosures and information that consumers need to make that informed decision is there. And so that when travelers are traveling to another country, or even, you know, inside of Ontario or inside of Canada, they're doing so with, you know, full information at hand.
So let's get into that. More complex, to me, kind of sounds like code for the cost will go up, travel insurance will, it's going to cost more to take a trip?
Yeah, you know, I think in general, you know, I wish I could say that prices will remain, you know, remain flat. But the reality is there's a huge pent-up demand. And I think there's upward price pressure. Travel operators, tourism companies, travel agencies, airlines, you know, they're looking to make up a lost ground. There are, you know, supply issues out there in terms of destinations, whether or not they're fully ready to receive travelers. So I think consumers should expect to see upward price pressure. And when it comes to insurance, this is where we really promote, encourage consumers to work with their travel advisor. Don't try to do it, you know, themselves, because insurance, as we know, you know, the devil's in the detail. There's lots of fine print. There's lots of rules. And no one insurance policy is the same. We have a requirement at TECO, you know, when a consumer is purchasing insurance, which, by the way, it's not mandatory. It's still a consumer's choice whether or not they want to purchase insurance or not, that they work with their travel advisor to understand who they're dealing with, what's in the policy, what sort of coverage is being provided, the distinction between trip cancellation and trip interruption, and cancellation, you know, by the various suppliers, whether it's the airline, the hotel, or whomever. All that needs to be really carefully researched and understood. And of course, now you've got the added challenge of understanding the coverages associated with COVID when you're in destination. Insurance could be complicated enough before COVID. I think it's continuing to evolve, and a lot of insurance providers have done a good job trying to explain it. But it's by no means is it finished yet. There's going to continue to be changes in those policies going forward, and you know, whether they're incorporated into the cost of the ticket or the package that the consumer buys. So this is where working with a professional travel advisor through a registered travel agency is something that we highly encourage consumers to do.
How divided do you think Canadians are on this idea of a vaccine passport to have proof at hand that you are vaccinated in order to travel?
Oh, yeah, that's a great question. It's somewhat of a relatively new concept, and it's under lots of scrutiny. So I think there is quite a bit of a division and uncertainty. It's sort of outside of TECO's direct scope, although clearly there's a link to consumer protection that, you know, when we all travel, we want to make sure those around us and the destination we're going to is herd immunity is being achieved. So the vaccination passports, I think there's a lot more work to be done on them. There's the many issues at play here. There's the economics, the social elements, privacy, diversity, in today's society, with the focus on the Me Too movement and diversity and systemic racism, we really need to be careful of discriminatory practices. And I know that's one of the big concerns from an ethical standpoint with these passports. However, I think when you balance everything out, and balance is the key, I think there is a role for those passports to play to give consumers the comfort and security that when they do travel, they're doing so safely. And I think that's the intent of the passports. But there's as I said earlier, the devil's in the detail and understanding how that's all going to work.
Richard Smart is CEO of the Travel Industry Council of Ontario. I'm Christine Ross, and this is the Zoomer Week in Review. Coming up, environmentalists urge us to continue living green post-pandemic.
You're listening to the Zoomer Week in Review, brought to you by CARP, fighting against ageism in the workplace and the marketplace. Find out more at carp.ca.
After more than a year of lockdown, many of us have lived a more sustainable lifestyle, sometimes not by choice, whether driving less to work or shopping less. And there's been hope amid a dark year as we celebrate Earth Day this coming Thursday. Vaccines were rolled out quicker than even the experts predicted, leaving some to argue if the world can unite to tackle an unseen monster like COVID-19, surely we can defeat an invisible beast like climate change. Not so fast, says Douglas MacDonald with the School of Environment at the University of Toronto, who argues they are distinctly different.
Well, it's difficult because the pandemic is an immediate emergency, and it is made urgent by the fact that people are dying from it. We've been working for the last 50 years or so trying to improve our levels of environmental protection. What the pandemic has shown is the reason that we've had so much trouble over the last 50 years. In the pandemic, even in a situation of absolute urgency and people dying, there's such incredible pressure in our society, a capitalist society that depends upon jobs and work. There's so much pressure to keep things opened up. That's why the provincial governments have vacillated so much between opening up and shutting down.
So let's just stick with the theme of the pandemic and climate change. Some are drawing a parallel between the two, calling them two big invisible monsters, and that if we can tackle COVID-19 on a united front globally, well, certainly could we not do the same for climate change? Is that a fair assessment?
It's fair in that they both present a global collective action problem that no one country or group of countries can solve either of their problems by themselves. You need global cooperation. But what the pandemic is showing us is that it's hard to find global cooperation. There's some effort to share vaccines, but we're seeing the rich nations looking out for themselves first.
So the federal conservatives recently, delegates were rejected, adding climate change is real, that one line into their policy book. And many drew comparisons to Donald Trump, who, you know, pulled the U.S. out of the Paris Climate Accord, the first nation to formally withdraw. How will this conservative decision or inaction on climate change impact the trajectory of the change in this country?
The fact that the conservatives, I mean, it's it's astounding to think about this, that a major political party in the year 2021 mm-hmm. could take the position that the issue does not exist. This is really hard to believe. But the way it's resonating with the Canadian public, the Trudeau Liberals have just brought in a plan to put the carbon tax up to $170 a ton. Nobody was talking about that kind of thing a few years ago. And yet right now, it's the Conservatives who are on the defensive because they don't believe in pricing, because they passed that kind of a resolution.
So getting back to this, you mentioned it's 2021, how a government can deny climate change is real. How do we, there are those out there, there are deniers. How do we report this? Because there really isn't another side to this story, given the science.
Well, it's difficult. To my mind, now this reflects my area that I do research in is environmental politics, mm-hmm. but to my mind, this reflects where we sit right now in the politics of the issue in Canada. And we have very clear division between governments which do believe the problem exists and are acting on it, such as the government of Quebec, the government of British Columbia, or the government of Canada headed by Justin Trudeau. And then we have other governments like the government of Alberta, the government of Saskatchewan, and the government of Ontario, which they no longer say that they don't believe the problem exists, but they're not acting on it. And in fact, they were actively, through their litigation before the Supreme Court, trying to prevent the federal government from acting on it. So I think that you and the news media and individual Canadians who are coming up to Earth Day and they're asking themselves, what can I be doing this Earth Day? And they may want to be making changes in their own lifestyle. They may want to make donations to environmental organizations. But I would also urge them to think the next time they have an opportunity to vote, think about the fact that we have a very clear divide between political parties that are acting and those which are not acting.
Well, you partially answered my next question then. So getting back to Earth Day for a moment, this will be the second one amid the pandemic coming up on Thursday. And, you know, every year people will dim their lights or conserve water. And we do this kind of once a year marketing campaign. But how can we all live more sustainably going forward beyond just Earth Day?
What we can all do is to recognize the basic nature of the issue, which is it's particularly for climate change, but also for other aspects of environmental protection, which is the intergenerational equity aspect of the issue. What we are doing is effectively saying we're not willing to pay the price of action, and therefore we're going to slide that price off our shoulders, and we're going to put it on the shoulders of our children, their children, and their children of future generations. And there's a real problem with doing that.
Well, that is a perfect lead-in to my final question. And you mentioned intergenerational. I need to speak about the activists. Everyone from 18-year-old Greta Thunberg to 83-year-old Jane Fonda have been on the front lines and have been very vocal. It's an issue now that seems to transcend age. All this a hopeful sign for you?
Absolutely. I spent considerable time at the University of Toronto working with students who were working to take action to try and convince governments to do more on the issue of climate change. And then to see the way young people, I have nothing but respect for Greta Thunberg. She's one of my heroes. Mm-hmm. I thought the speech she gave at the United Nations ranks right up there with Martin Luther King in terms of the powerful, powerful speech. And the fact that young people have got this message that they're the ones who are being asked to pay this price, and they're standing up and they're saying, no, we won't. I see that as absolutely hopeful.
Douglas MacDonald, thank you so much for joining us.
You're very welcome. It's been a pleasure speaking with you.
Douglas MacDonald is Senior Lecturer Emeritus with the School of the Environment at the University of Toronto. And that brings us to the end of this week's edition of the Zoomer Week in Review. I'm Christine Ross in for Libby Snymer. Thanks for joining me today, and be sure to come back next week to stay up to date with all things Zoomer worldwide.
Zoomer Week in Review is produced by Zeev Hadi, Christine Ross, and Paul Thomas.
Technical producer, Justin Eacock. Executive producer, Moses Neimer.
This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.